You are listening to the Frilla Bros Tech Podcast, episode 289. Apple opens up about the Mac Pro and reveals internal struggles. Season 7, episode 289 of the Frilla Bros Tech Podcast. Today is April the 9th, 2017. I'm Matthew Dean Furlow, and delivering the first pitch is my brother, James Furlow.
Yeah, I think the Giants are going to go all the way this year. I think they got it.
Yeah, it's one of those on-again, off-again years.
Maybe.
You don't think?
Technically, that was last year, but you know, who's counting?
Exactly. Who is counting? Not the Giants.
Just makes it doubly more likely this year.
Exactly. They're going to win two this year.
Boom!
Yeah. Or maybe it'll be the A's. Who knows? That could happen.
Maybe.
That can't happen.
Doubt it.
Makes me sad. I don't know. I like their cheap.
You could be a Giants fan. That's allowed.
I'm a Giants fan. I own both hats, man. I'm shameless.
You're a Baumgartner fan, really. I mean, that's.
I know.
He's kind of awesome.
I do love Baumgartner. He's a robot. I'm He's so good, it's crazy. But
I watched That Explains It. Netflix has been giving me a bunch of baseball movies lately this last week. And I just go with it. You're like, cool, baseball.
But
that's really fascinating. I did not put that together. I watched two baseball movies last week and I didn't really like it. Isn't until this very moment that I put together that's why that's happening.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, it was, you get on Netflix, and I want to kill some time. And I saw a movie, it was Trouble with the Curve. And it had Clint Eastwood and Amy Adams. Like, yeah.
I mean. Like,
you can't deny that. And so it had Justin Timberlake, and I was like, sure, I don't mind the man. And fantastic movie, by the way. It was a classic Clint Eastwood film, but without any shooting.
Nice.
It was pretty, but it was like, it had that same feel and ethos where, yes, it just worked at the end. It was super good. Yeah, it was good. So I watched that one, and then I watched Mr. 3000.
Oh, yeah.
Literally, I think today is when I watched that one.
Nice.
Which is a, what is his name?
Yeah. I know, I can visualize.
It's not Sinbad, it's the other guy.
No, it's not Sinbad.
No. I cannot think of his name. You're looking him up. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
But
Bernie Mac. There we go.
Yeah, Bernie Mac, which I would not peg him as a baseball player at all, but, he makes it work.
I think that's part of what makes that movie good, though, right? Is that he's an over-the-hill, was a baseball player, and he's like,
yeah,
retired guy.
I guess so. It's a classic redemption story.
Yeah, it's awesome.
With no twists.
Hey,
no curves, if you will.
Okay, it's just because it showed up, I'm going to click over. Oh, 54% on Rotten Tomatoes. Not a lot of love. Deliberately, Louisville slugs its audience over the head. That's pretty good.
That's funny.
I did not watch any baseball stuff on Netflix this week because Netflix picked up One Punch Man, which...
One Punch Man.
It's fantastic. It's short, which is a blessing. It's just the first season. 12 episodes, 22 minutes an episode, but they're... It's a satire of like your Dragon Ball Z style anime, and like the whole the character, his thing is he can defeat any enemy with one punch, which sounds like it'd be really boring. Like, okay, so he's could just defeat literally any enemy with one punch, but that's like the thing. That's his. It's brilliant in that that's like what the entire story arc is about, is how he deals with being like this unbelievably powerful superhero. It's just really well written, and it's It's got some, one of those shows where it's like, it's actually got laugh out loud moments in it. And it's nice. It's pretty funny. And
I recently got sucked into Iron Fist, which is it's a Marvel Netflix original type of thing. Not nearly as intense as some of the other ones I've done.
I was going to say good, but yeah, okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm only like 1.5 episodes into it.
It's fine.
I already feel myself going like, interesting. We'll see if it lasts. Probably will know in me.
It's fine.
No spoilers, man. I'm watching it.
Okay. In all fairness, I'm only 6 episodes in, but
okay.
I got really excited and watched it when it first came out, and I want to be ready for the Defenders, which has already been announced.
Oh yeah.
So like I'm like, oh, I gotta finish this because like I know these characters are gonna be in that, but it's taking my time, man. I'm taking my time.
I watched League of Legends on Netflix. That was
like the video game?
No, it's a movie on Netflix.
League of Legends.
Yeah. It's about time travel.
It's a movie.
Superheroes from all the different universi in DC, though. No, it's a Netflix thing. Series. I'm pretty sure it's certain that's what it's called.
You gotta look it up, because there's a League of Legends documentary, which is about the video game League of Legends.
All right, here, hold on.
Legends of the Fall?
League. I don't even know how to spell League. Of Ledge. All right.
It's Legends something. Of Tomorrow. You're talking about...
Is that what it is? Legends of Tomorrow?
Yeah, it's got like...
Yeah, Legends of Tomorrow.
There we go.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Legends. I was so confused. It's like, what are you saying? It's got time-traveling superheroes. DC ones. What? That's really funny. Yeah, no, League of Legends is that giant esport, right? That's like... It's a thing. I understand why it was stuck in your head, but it's just definitely a different thing. One's fair worth enough. Distinctly more money than the other.
Also fair enough.
But interesting, man. Interesting. It's been kind of a slow week for pop culture. I'm going to be honest. It's been like if you're running behind, this is the week to catch up. Nothing going on. So without further ado, James, this week, like every week, we're going to be talking about technology and continuing corporate opera. No more video games, no more movies, more TV shows. We're right into it. When we say the corporate opera, what we mean is the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, we got a short disclosure we want to throw your way.
I founded and work for a company that creates and ships the latest and greatest PCs on the market. However, I do not represent HPI. You thought it was Apple. Or any other of HPI's opinions. I also own one of the prime social networks on the internet, Twitter. One of the biggest markets, online markets. Not Amazon, that'd be Etsy. And one of the largest lending institutions, Lending Club, not Wells Fargo or Bank of America.
Hey, what's your thing?
Underdog, apparently.
HP Inc. is your, what's your NASDAQ? Your
HPQ. We got to keep the original.
HPQ. Nice. You guys got to keep
compact or
you,
corporate.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay. This is just to tell you the sort of mood that I'm in. Although I do not disagree with your assessment of who makes best desktops, you could be bought by Apple like six times.
That'd be excellent if we were. I'd be okay with that.
Yeah. Which really makes the statement you make astounding. But we will get into that as we get further into the show. We're not going to start there. I'm just going to say, A, I made some predictions that have come true at the beginning of the year during an annual prediction show. I feel good about that. But I also made a pretty bold statement last week about where if Apple is going and where it needs to go, and my reaction if they do not go there, and they announce this week they're not going there. I gotta think long and hard about what I want. Was I just spouting off last week, or am I ready to make a change? Anyways, we're not starting there. James is going to town. What's up, man? You're up first. Or should I be up first?
Oh, you can follow me on James Furlough and other places online.
That's completely right. Oh man.
That's why I took a bite.
All right. Well, you can do that. But if you want to follow me on so funny. Calling you out, I'm in trouble. If you want to follow me online, I'm at Matthew D. Furlough. My next wig in four is Instagram. And if you want to get more about the show in general, go to furloughbros.com, where you can check out all the clicks, links, videos, audio, everything that we talk about this week. If you want proof, cold, hard facts, that's where you go. Also, if you don't want to go there because it's like too hard to type in, you have to go once, but after that, you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter where we will deliver all of this amazing content to your inbox, which is a really great kind of a week in review of tech and highly curated for your consumption. Also, you can like read along with the show. It's like an adventure that we're going to go on together. So yeah, check it out.
So I have a writer. I have a couple writers whom I love, whom I adore, who I read everything that they write. Okay. Cool. Online, I should say. Seth Godin is one of them. He has his book out. Man, I've thought long and hard about getting it. It's essentially a book that has all of his blog posts. It's like 4 inches thick. It's ridiculous. And it's like $200. He's like, it's a coffee table piece. I'm like, and you look at it and the sucker's huge.
Yeah.
Then I've read like all of them, so I'm like, I don't think I need that. But anyways, I've read a couple other books about that he has. He's a marketing genius. Anyways, he wrote this piece, and it was about the title of it is 23 Things Artificially Intelligent Computers Can Do Better, Faster, Cheaper Than You Can. And I thought it was interesting. He doesn't really mean artificial intelligence. I think he just means like that computers can do better than you.
Yeah.
I think. Anyways, some examples he gives.
I would say this. There are some levels of machine learning, which is generally like that's become synonymous with AI today. In pretty much every one of these examples, there's some degree of machine learning going on.
Which is why I am continually telling the team that I work on, like, we're going to start calling this a machine learning tool. Like, it's artificially intelligent. Because all we're going to do is we're going to have it run multiple forecasts and then select which one it thinks is the best. Like, dude, that sounds smart.
Dude, I got news for you. That is, like, by and large. Like, I've started taking, like, machine learning classes, and like the happening cool ones that everybody likes to talk about are neural networks and convolutional neural networks and stuff. But that's a subset of the machine learning industry. And a big part of the machine learning industry is how do you run a bunch of like statistical models and then pick the most useful one, and like how does it determine the difference between them? That's fully legit, man. That's like
cool. All right. Well, we're making one. And I was telling everyone, anyways, but my point was, I was like, we're going to call it that, whether it is it or not.
Yes, here we go.
I was like, that was my takeaway. And I was like, because that's the new hotness, and we just need to be saying it. Like, we have this one program we call it Big Data, which it's not. It's a lot of data, but it's not big data by the classic terms.
How would you define those difference? That the difference.
So there? Something like big data, A, there's a lot of data points to begin with, but then B, it's also bringing together multiple measures into one database so that you can then make decisions off of things. So the classic example is always Target, where it was not only did it have a lot of sales data, but it had a bunch of data on the different items you were buying. And so then it could put things together and go, oh, people who buy this tend to buy that. There's a natural progression.
Let me throw out a math term that I'll see if you agree with this, but that the data sets were highly dimensional.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. And so another classic one, which I actually really like this one, it was when Obama was running, they used big data. And what they had was they had a database of registered voters, specifically Democrats. And through that, they would ask questions and do surveys. And they found that there were certain actors that Democrats liked. And the one example was they found out that, like, oh, they're all into George Clooney movies. I don't know how they found that out, but that was through that data. And so they put together a fundraiser where it was like, an auction, I guess, where it was like biggest donor gets a date with George Clooney or gets to have lunch with him or something like that.
What? You know?
And people went crazy for it. And he raised a ridiculous sum of money. And they kept doing things like that.
You know,
Go ahead.
You know, the other thing that they did during that campaign that was really smart and really worked out for them is they ran against a guy who had a hard time acting like he wasn't in artificial intelligence. They could have.
That helps.
Okay.
It helps. So,
a bit robotic is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. And so anyways, so like with ours, we measure one thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So it's just to make some of those other inferences about customers who do this are also likely to do that. We can't make those inferences. And that's where big data is super useful. But anyways, neither here nor there.
That also seems to be one of the other differentiators with machine learning is how do you take statistical models to validate those? How do you take something that is highly dimensional? So it's got, you know, and a dimension being anything that you can measure. And so it's like, you know, not just, like you said, not just the person, their sex, their age, their location, but also things like the size, you know, not just the things that they buy, but the volumes of what they buy. And, because now you're into these things that like all these different characteristics that have multiple characteristics on characteristics. And how do you ease out meaning out of that where, you know, statistical models need to get complicated fast because you can't, especially when you can't just brute force the answer.
Yeah. And so funnily, we just hired somebody or we're going to or something like that. Anyways, she worked, I guess it's past tense now, for Amazon. Her job, I love this, was to predict when people would quit Amazon.
Whoa.
And they have a data set on each of their employees. And so we were kind of joking. We were like, man, I wonder if she had a Minority Report moment where like her name popped up on the dashboard. Like, oh no. And they literally like they're checking when you key into the office, when you log onto your computer, when you log off. They're tracking all sorts of things like that. If you're working from home, if you're in the office, I'm sure there's a bunch of things. And again, that's like they have all the data from all the different employees, and she finds statistically valid models to figure out, oh, this person's getting ready to go because their behavior changes. Apparently, I hasn't started working for us yet, so I can't dive a lot into the details, but I will because that sounds awesome.
It does sound awesome.
Kind of crazy, but at the same time, like that's an example of a big data thing. Anyways, so artificial intelligence, he gives some examples.
Yeah, back to the article.
He gives some examples of things that I, the way I would say it is just computers in general can do better, faster, cheaper than you. Like one of them is predict the weather, read an x-ray, go, you know, play Go, figure out the profit and loss of a large company, count calories, fly a jet across the country. How true is that? Book a flight. Or I was even like, look up the cheapest flight. you know, maintain the temperature in your house. Create an index for a book. Weld a metal seam. Trade stocks. Place online ads. Monitor a premature newborn. Detect a fire. Play poker. Read documents in a lawsuit and sort packages.
Yeah.
That's a handful of them. And the point he's trying to make is that, you know, we see a lot of, and we talk a lot about disruptive AI and how it's going to change everything. And his point is, and I thought this was interesting, he goes, no, it's probably going to look a lot like it does in the past. Because a lot of those things I mentioned, like, they're happening. you know? And he's like, it just nibbles. And I thought this paragraph was just clutch. He says, artificial intelligence does a job we weren't necessarily crazy about doing anyway. It does it quietly and well, and then we take it for granted. No one complained when their thermostat took over the job of building a fire, opening the grate, opening a window, rebuilding a fire. And no one complained when the computer found 100 fights faster and better than we could. But the system doesn't get tired. It keeps nibbling. Not with benign or malintent, but with a focus of clear, defined, with a clearly defined task. And I'm just like, oh.
It is interesting to me that he would say, and nobody noticed. Because to me, the problem has always been with all of this stuff is it is the nibbling. He's absolutely right. It's about the nibbles. But it's like my best friend growing up, his mom owned a travel agency.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's closed now. It's not a travel agency anymore because of artificial intelligence. Like, you know, yeah. and you might say it's because of the internet, but it's as much the artificial intelligence as it is the internet. The internet helped her originally because she could more easily contact the flights, and her skill set was still useful. She had a unique, unreplicatable skill set. And to me, I've said this before, and it's, man, I'm becoming a bit of a broken record about this with my friends, and I'm considering that I might have to measure myself on this because I come across as pessimistic, but it's this idea of, especially people in particular in this industry, mechanical engineers who use 3D CAD software to do the design work and turn it into 2D like programs. That's going away. And it's all going to be this slow incremental, like, a devouring of our jobs. Because if you think about it, what, you know, 2 decades ago, even that short, it was, you'd sit down, you'd come up with designs, and you'd have a handful of drafters for even a small company, just because creating the drawings was that difficult. And then once you got to the 2D CAD, where you could draw them on computers, like, it became more efficient, and you didn't need as many people. And then once it got to the 3D modeling, you got more efficient and you didn't need as many people. And now a lot of these companies that 2 decades ago had, you know, a handful of drafters have one mechanical engineer who does all of the work. And eventually those software packages are going to go get so efficient that it'd be dumb to hire a mechanical engineer. You'll just outsource it to one. And one engineer will be able to handle 3 companies. And then eventually what will happen is, you know, this all goes to the companies that are building these software packages are going to run into an issue where they're like, wow, we're not making nearly as much money because we have one mechanical engineer that we're selling to, fewer and fewer. What we want to do instead is sell to the bosses and say, yeah, we want to replace the mechanical engineer. You're paying your ME, you know, 60, 80, 100,000, whatever. You pay us half that, and we'll give you a software package that allows you to do all of the hardcore engineering work with a couple of push buttons, and you can talk to it, you know. And the idea that that wouldn't happen over the course of 30 years and my industry would just go away, like, quietly into the night, it'd be more and more and more difficult to get a job out of college, and you'd find something else to do if you could find something else to do. You know,
when you think about something like, remember when the web first came out, like, you could make a living building websites for people, and you could charge ridiculous, you know, it's $15,000 to build a website.
That, like, is such a great example.
I could have one for you in an hour, and I'm not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and now all of the web building, they stopped building website tools for like Amazon, or not Amazon, Adobe stopped building like Dreamweaver, and now it's all Squarespace. It's all go like completely, they originally were building tools to make the designers more efficient. Now they're building tools to allow you to get completely around the designers. Which is especially great if you're kind of artistic to begin with and you have a vision for what you want your thing to be, because now you don't really need to know the tech side of it and you can just, you can just explode it onto the website. So it's only the super specialized websites that don't use the sorts of tools that Adobe makes anyway.
So I'm working on I'm mocking up a website for a project I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I used jQuery, their mobile version of it.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's done. I did it in a week. And it was ridiculous how little coding I had to do to make it work. I mean, fully customized. And I was just in shock. Because in the past, I used to just figure out all the CSS and do it myself. And this time I was like, dude, I'm lazy. I just want to get this done. And found jQuery and went, oh, I'll just plug this in. And it just auto-formatted everything, made it all work. And I was like, oh, this is brilliant.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. Well, and that's the point, and that's the direction this goes. So it's unfair to say that nobody notices. I think we're in this weird place where it's like my friend's mom. She had been very, very successful, and she was at a point in her life where she actually contracted with another travel agency, a bigger travel agency, and worked super part-time and basically was retired within like a year. I mean, it was like all she did was the few clients she had, she transferred over to this other agency, was effectively what she was doing for a short period, and it's like, not missing, or is that like, I don't even know how to define that, because the problem is, and this is the thing that I always come back to, is it's, could you get to the point where the tools to automate other jobs become so efficient that you can automate automation? And then at that point, and by that, when I say automation, I don't mean fully autonomous general purpose AI. I just mean one or two engineers can design software packages that used to take 100 engineers and that software package would be replacing what used to take 1,000 whatevers, accountants, to do the job of. And now you have, two engineers basically disrupting.
I think so. I mean, I think about I think about the book industry. And that, to me, has that similar feel. I was trying to figure out, is there like an analogy to it? Where it's like, that idea to publish a book still requires some work, but so much of it's an automate now. Maybe it's the same as a website deal.
It's pretty similar to a website, man. The hard part is coming up with a clever story, and you're not going to get paid for it. I mean, even if like I subscribe to a bunch of websites and stuff, and it's like, nobody gets paid for books anymore. Maybe you'll get a couple of grand. If you make it to the top of the Amazon bestseller book list and you beat out, some of your giant names, you'll end up with a $4,000 or $5,000 payday. You're like, what? Wow. Whereas the paydays don't come along until you get a movie deal or a TV deal. That's what books are now. Which if you enjoy storytelling and you enjoy having a fan base and you enjoy writing, that's worth it. It's its own reward, but it's better be its own reward because you're not going to get super rich doing it, man. But at the same time, you don't have to struggle with publishers really, because you can just pay people to pay people and use automated tools and boom, your book's published. And the publishing houses are getting to the point where unless you're a big name, they don't want to deal with you because they're just like, no, go, like, no, we're, if we can't get you on Ellen to be pushing your book as part of a movie deal, then we don't want to deal with you.
Right.
Oh,
that's so true.
It's interesting, man.
It is.
AI. Software is devouring the world. It's going to be good, I think, overall. So you want to know a software companies that have really really changed the world themselves, James?
Sure.
Yahoo and AOL.
Oh, both, man, classics.
Both subsidiaries of Verizon.
That's so true.
Are joining a single company, and they and they're renaming themselves to Oath.
To Oath?
Oath.
Like, I make a promise or a pledge?
That's what they seem to be implying. It seems like...
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Oath.
Oath. Oath.com. It seems... It's weird because it seems like an overreaction to the fact that nobody trusts Yahoo right now. We're going to... Not only has Yahoo become synonymous with data breaches that we're going to lie to you about, but we're just not... It's not just going to get rid of that brand name because it's toxic, but we're going to try to imply the exact opposite with Oath. Seems like a real...
So what are they oathing to do?
Nobody really... Well, see, that's the weird part. Is it's just they're going to keep doing what they're doing. They're going to keep Yahooing about. They're going to keep doing Yahoo Finance and Yahoo Mail and Yahoo everything, except it'll
or
be...
Oath.
Oath. I think they're going to keep the Yahoo Mail because that's your like home address, and it would be really weird for a lot of people to change.
I don't know, man. Microsoft flipped everyone over to Live.
That's true.
Or Outlook or something, but MSN still works.
Is that what happens? Is it just like routes forwards everything? I guess that would be pretty easy
that's
to do.
Guess.
It's not like they don't own the Yahoo.com domain, so they could just set it up as a port forwarding and say, look, this is your new email. You will still get emails from other people, so if you...
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, but they're going to keep doing their thing with sports and news and all those really... What do they do? That's a really good question, James.
They've got a portal.
Yeah, AOL.com.
Go to.
Trump aides make conflicting remarks on Syria. Assad. Okay, so nope. Definitely going to block notifications from AOL.
Oh, yeah, look at that. They don't allow.
Oh, awesome.
Is this video going to start playing automatically? Yes.
They have, oh my gosh. They have your astrological signs.
And cool. Which one am I?
At first I thought it was an ad. I was like, why have the ad block? No, this is just...
You might prefer to withdraw into seclusion today, but your attempts to hide won't likely work. After all, it's nearly impossible to disappear once the responsive moon returns to your sign. Oh, see full horoscope. I'm in.
Let's see. Leo.
Oh, fighting the distractions. You may... whatever. I don't care anymore.
Ironically, your confidence about your path in life may be waning as your horizons widen. It's increasingly difficult to reconcile previous decisions with our newly expanding perspective. That is so dumb. Could you be any more vague and just upload? Oh, jeez.
I've been ruined ever since the Weird Al song.
Yeah, I feel that.
You're so great. Just so wonderful.
It's worth checking out if you haven't before.
Anything less than that, you're just like, man, either like just give me full on positive, you know, build me up, or just go the opposite like him.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah,
everything will be great.
So
until you get hit by a bus.
Yeah. evidently they're going to do shopping and video and games and lifestyle and finance and entertainment. And it sounds exactly like the Yahoo lineup. It's like you said, that's exactly what it is. It's just a portal. It's a front page to a couple of things of interest.
Those things work.
Evidently.
Yes, they do.
Verizon's bought a couple of them.
Who said Verizon's smart?
Oh, yeah. Well, touche, man.
Yeah, they'll keep you. That it'll be the great, the best place to keep getting your horoscopes. God dang it, man! I just, what a pathetic.
Maybe we're the weird ones who have like specific news sources where, like, I don't log in online and go, I wonder what's happening today, and go to a specific web page to find out. Which maybe I should. I mean, you do. You go to Reddit, I guess.
Yeah, that's sort of my point. Is it's like Dig and Reddit. Just there's no community based around it. It's highly curated. It's particular editors putting together articles and sources and stuff. It'd be like somebody who goes to Drudge or BuzzFeed or whatever. They're all kind of the same. They're media websites with.
I was talking to a person last Friday. She said, like, she goes, oh, I get all my news on Facebook. I was like, really? How do you feel about the latest controversy?
that explains a lot. Yeah, I'm sure that we're going to have audience members that are right now that are going to be freaking out about the fact that I just said Drudge and BuzzFeed are the same. they're going to be really upset about one of those two being compared to the other. And I could go either way.
I love BuzzFeed YouTube videos. They're awesome.
You know,
I get sucked into them every once in a while. Just like, oh.
BuzzFeed is.
The Try Guys. I love those dudes. What can I say?
BuzzFeed has done what you're supposed to do with a company. You have a gimmick. You get a lot of attention. You start to get some money. And then you hire real people to do a better job. And they've gotten their act together. I mean, BuzzFeed was one of the guys that actually got into our next story. This feels like, you know what? I'm gonna point out the fact that this is a perfect transition, thereby ruining the transition. So Apple invited a handful of of people to their campus for a private little get together, and BuzzFeed was one of the journalists that they invited. So
I noticed that.
I mean,
now I'm also noticing. Like, do you have the best write up of it?
Which by who?
You don't. Daring Fireball.
Oh.
He gave like a play-by-play. Here's what happened.
Yeah.
I'm going to link to it because it was awesome, but keep going.
Yeah, so basically, John Gruber. Yeah, good times, man. So, so Apple had a sit-down meeting, and this week they invited a handful of journalists like John Gruber of Daring Fireball. They invited TechCrunch and Engadget and any usual suspects, The Verge, The BuzzFeed, stuff like that. And it was a handful of the execs of the company, not including Timothy Cook or Jonathan Ives.
Sorry.
And then they had a little discussion about the current state of their pro computers, not about the MacBook Pro that seems to be selling incredibly well. I think it's a transitionary laptop. The more and more like I learn about it, and more I look at it, I think it's super overpriced. I think it's because they wanted to raise the price of their pro level computers, and they'll bring all the prices down next year. That's like a normal thing for Apple to do. And everybody's always upset that first generation that they do that. It was like with the Apple, the original MacBook Air, it was crazy expensive and everybody freaked out. And we're like, who would buy this? This is ridiculous. And Apple was like, nobody's supposed to buy this. This is just supposed to reset our high price point. So when we raise all the prices of all the other MacBooks next year, no, people won't be so crazy because it won't be as high as the MacBook Airs. And then they brought the MacBook Airs down to kind of get everybody happy and feeling good about the price cuts. So anyways, that's not what they were complaining about. Not the MacBook Air or the MacBook Pro. I mean, MacBook Pro seems to be doing fine. What they were talking about specifically was the Mac Pro and its kind of little brother, the iMac. They said they basically were getting at, hey, we really care about pro consumers. We care about the professional market. we recognize that we haven't been really doing them justice, and we've got plans. One of the things that they pre-announced, one piece of vaporware in a Pro iMac, which, for the record, for the starts, the beginning of the year, that's what I predicted, was that we'd get a Pro iMac, there'd be no MacBook Pro, or no Mac Pro. And then they also said, oh yeah, and there's not going to be a Mac Pro this year. And so it's 2 for 2. I loved it. It kind of goes, there's this systemic issue that they were talking about, that basically what happened was they designed themselves into a thermal corner, as they described it. The Mac Pro, if you're not familiar, it's a cylindrical shape. It's about a foot tall. It sits on your desktop, and inside of it is this chunk of aluminum that has been milled out to work as a heat sink. And it looks like a triangular prism. On one face, you have the CPU, and on the other two faces, you have dual GPUs. When this thing launched, it was a ferocious beast of a processor. And what was really interesting about it at the time was it was very expensive. It started at $3,000 compared to, you know, other pro computers. But when you actually compared that kind of processing power to building your own computer or buying it from somebody else on the market, if you wanted that same kind of processing power, you actually couldn't get it cheaper. Which was pretty phenomenal. And that was, it was one of those weird, you felt like you were paying Apple tax at the time because it was so expensive. But the truth was, it was actually the best financial deal. And so they sold a lot of them. There was a couple of complaints that were raised at the time. Number one, it was difficult. You couldn't upgrade it yourself. Everything was soldered to the board, so you couldn't like replace the GPUs, the graphics cards. You couldn't upgrade the RAM. And there were some concerns about that. But they're like, you know, as long as Apple updates it every year, and it'll just become a business expense that, you know, every couple of years you got to replace your Mac Pro and throw out the new one and buy a brand new one. Kind of like with your MacBook Pros, with your laptops. And so we understood what they were going to do. And so people, even if you weren't excited about it, that they were getting rid of the modular Mac Pro, the old cheese grater model, as they described it, people were fine with it. And then they really executed on that plan by year after year, upgrading it so that it would stay at the highest, like high end. It was the most powerful desktop computer you could get on the market, and it also happened to be the most support. Wait a second. Sorry, I'm getting incoming news here. No, that's not what they did. They didn't touch it for over 3.5 years, and it's just languished and is this pathetic chunk of metal now that is insanely overpriced, underpowered. It utilizes old architectures, and it just is, it's inconceivable how this thing still exists. And it is all the more infuriating considering the fact that, as we pointed out earlier, that HP builds better, you can build buy a more powerful desktop like easily and cheaply from HP for right now with industrial design that people want. And it is a company worth a sixth of Apple's cash pile. Not even a sixth of Apple, but a sixth of the cash on hand that Apple could just buy HP with. It's insane. It is the most. And basically what they're saying was that the issue was that at the time when they announced the original device, the belief was that GPUs were going to be going down the direction of smaller GPUs, that they weren't as physically large, they weren't as physically hot, but you'd have two of them. And then NVIDIA came out with a couple of architectures just allowed them to that made that design not make sense. And the dual GPUs. And so they stuck with the single GPUs. They really started to beat down, who was their competition? Oh man, what's the name of that company? I can't remember all of a sudden. NVIDIA versus AMD. Whew. AMD ended up, they really took a lot of market share from AMD, which the chips in the Mac Pro were AMD chips, and AMD started chasing down NVIDIA, trying to catch up with their level of production and performance. And according to the Apple execs in this meeting, that painted them into a what they described as a thermal corner, where mm-hmm. they couldn't design a way to expound the amount of heat that was being generated. The thing just couldn't handle it. And they couldn't figure out a way to modify the design to deal with that. And so they haven't been able to upgrade because they haven't been able to get better GPUs, because the better GPUs that are available don't work with it. Now, why it took them 3.5 years to figure that out, why it will take them another at least year to design a new one is inconceivable to me. Actually, there's a lot of theories.
You know, I think they had a lot of debates internally on whether or not they should update it at all. And that's partially what took so long.
Yeah, I guess there's the theory that I tend to buy into is that Johnny Ives didn't like the idea of doing it. Tim Cook's we're a mobile first company. Maybe we should be a mobile only company. And so the two most important people in the world in Apple when it comes to their design ethos, the CEO and the chief designer, were both kind of against the Mac Pro in principle. And Johnny Ives said, well, if we're going to make the Mac Pro, we're going to make the Mac Pro like we make everything else. It's going to be beautiful. It's going to look great on your desk. And you're going to have to replace it every 2 to 3 years to stay current. And so they got rid of the modular form factor. They made it incredibly small. And they made design choices that were rather short-sighted for a long-term production. And the consequence of that has been a real, it's been painful. One of the interesting things that Apple has done over the last couple of years is they've really gone out of their way to make sure that there's no product that they have that can't run on the iPhone. And obviously that's not entirely true, but it's like, if you look at iWorks had a giant number of features, and all sorts of tools that you could use. And it was, and then they came out with the new version of iWorks that was compatible with the iPhone, and it had the web version and everything. And the first thing and most companies, when they come out with a mobile version of their app, there's the full featured version on the desktop, and then like the light version that you have on your phone. And Apple didn't go that direction. They stripped down the desktop version so that the light version was the full featured version. And there wasn't,
which is why I don't use iWork anymore.
Yep.
Cause they killed, let's see. Well, I've never used Numbers, cause that was just always weak sauce. I used Pages all the time, but then they killed the number one feature I was using it for in that process. So that one was out. I guess Keynote's still pretty good. I just don't tend to make a lot of presentations. Right.
I use Pages all the time, but I just do like straight writing. I'm not doing collaborative features. I'm not doing like complex documents. I'm just writing. So it's not it, which is.
You're not trying to mail merge or anything crazy like that?
I know. And by crazy, you mean not crazy. Like, simple features. How is this so hard?
You used to have it.
I know. and that's the thing, is that that's just been the ethos of the company. We've talked about how the structure of the company has been, like, instead of having, like, the Mac division and the iPad division and the iPhone division, they have, like, instead of having this company split into product verticals like most companies would be, the groups are like the iMessages groups. They have the operating system groups, and the operating system group does all of the operating systems, And their goal is to have this homogenous operating system where they're all the features and the design and the feel of everything across the board are all the same. And that's just so clearly what was going on with the company for the last couple of years. And all of a sudden they're losing the high end professional users. And I there's a lot of people that are praising this move for Apple and being like, oh my gosh, like they finally are figuring their thing out. And I kind of shrug my shoulders. I'm like, I don't think that's true. I think what happened was a certain number of the executives understand why it's important to please that super small segment of this of their market.
That's, what they say was less than 10%.
Yeah, which in just and it is completely reasonable to say that like financially it doesn't make sense. That's not where they make their money. That's not where they're ever going to make their money.
So what I heard is they're going to come out with an iMac Pro,
right?
And then they'll have a Mac Pro, which will be some monstrosity, huge extendable thing,
right?
Right?
Correct.
And so not ignoring it. I feel like they suddenly realized that there was a gap in the portfolio.
Well, I think it's more complicated than that because I think that that's what they're trying to portray it as is, oh, we realized that we accidentally did that for the last 3.5 years. Like when people have been screaming their heads off about it, I think they decided at this point that there was no point in developing professional grade like computers. That as Steve Jobs described it, there was the trucks, which are your high-end computers, and that there will always be a segment of society that has trucks, but most people move over to sedans. Most people move over to mobile computers that are more based around consumption and light productivity as opposed to heavy productivity. And Apple just decided to abandon the heavy productivity, or at least say, we're going to model the heavy productivity off of the light productivity stuff. And it just didn't work. It didn't work from how you build the hardware. It didn't work from a software perspective. I think that's my biggest concern is that it doesn't work from a software perspective. Like to me, the whole idea is that these professional people are supposed to be the tip of the spear. They're leading the charge. They're yeah. the ones that are figuring out where the next level of technology is going. Like the idea that Apple is developing an augmented reality, system for their phone, which they're clearly doing, and that's where they want to go with it. But yet they didn't build a computer that allowed developers to develop AR content. What?
Which again, I think is back to the core issue. They made a bet and they were wrong.
Yeah.
And so they weren't set up for VR.
Yeah.
And my guess is the new ones will be. That's my guess.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not a hope. It's just a guess. But
and it's interesting. NVIDIA this week they announced a new monster of a GPU. It's in a class of its own. It's a $1,200 graphics card.
Wow.
Yeah. But they also announced that they are going to start writing drivers for Macs, which everybody was like, "What?" Especially because they did it the day before Apple brought everybody together to say we're making modular Macs. They're like, why? Why are you doing this? Which tends to suggest that they caught wind of what Apple is doing and they're going to try to prepare themselves to be in that to be in that market. I don't know, man. I'm like, it is a company that is so wealthy right now, and they're succeeding on momentum so hard. I just like, it's hard to believe that Apple is getting away with this at all. I don't think they are. And I think it just points to a larger systemic issue with the company of like, who are you? What do you do? Who's in charge? Who's making decisions? Like, what direction is this company going? And it seems to really point to this, like, the fact that they're making this announcement, the fact that they're trying to satisfy pro users tells me that, like, things got really far off the rails for Apple to deviate this gigantically from their
It reminds me, there was a time when we were we're talking about forecasting for printer sales, and the question was, well, how many, you know, the question was, how many printers will we sell? And the answer for a lot of years was, how many can we produce this quarter?
Yeah.
Like, we'll sell them all if we can make them fast enough. Like, we literally could not, like, the demand way outstripped the supply. Sound familiar?
Yes.
And then what was interesting was eventually the market was saturated. It matured. It peaked. And HP had not invested in any, like, real marketing, real forecasting, things like that. And then all of a sudden found itself going like, oh, we actually have to create these capabilities and these skills. And now you had this weird situation where you could no longer just throw gobs of money at the problem because you weren't growing anymore.
Right.
And executives wanted an ROI, and you were trying to explain to them, well, I know we're not growing anymore, but we want to spend a whole lot more now to do this.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, for what, you know, the way I just described it, you would think an executive would go, oh, we're part of that life cycle. Got it. You know?
Yeah.
It didn't work that way. And I get that sense that Apple's kind of going through that same thing, and they compounded the problem by losing the dude with the vision and who had it all in his head. And not, you know, not malicious or anything. It's just, that's the way it was. He had the vision, right?
Right.
And it's not, so it's not like he didn't share it. It just, that's just where it came from. And I think that what the comment you made was so right, where like, no, they're cruising on momentum. And I think they find themselves in a few places where it's like, oh, like, we got to figure out a roadmap. We can't just create something and people are going to love it anymore.
Yeah.
And we can't ignore, I don't want to say it. They're in this mode where they still are just focusing on a handful of products.
Yeah.
But they let their portfolio get bigger than a handful of products.
Right. Yeah.
and at the time, like, they can get away with it. And now they're finding they can't. And they're so big that even 9% is not a small number.
Right.
Of people. Well,
and I come back to, it's like, there's been just a hammering of complaints about the whole Apple not updating and improving their cinema displays, their yeah. high-end displays,
which is in the works apparently. Yeah,
and it's weird that that would be such an issue, because you're like, well, there are great displays out there by other companies. Does Apple need to be in this business?
Yeah, but people want to be looking at the fruit
right.
when working on their machines.
And there are technologies that they've built into things like the IMAX, where at the 5K iMac with the true color technology, right? That color corrects based on the ambient light in the room. So you
unless you have an older one like myself, then it doesn't for some inexplicable reason.
Yeah, well, you know.
Don't tell me it's too old.
No. Get a new one, James. That's the reason.
Yeah, I know.
And so the idea that they couldn't build a cinema display that has that, and instead they got those LG 5K monitors that they have in their stores that have huge software yeah. and hardware bugs that are like constantly having issues. And this is their like, this is your flagship thing that you're gonna put in your. On your, you know, on your shop floor, like your Apple, it's supposed to just work, man. Like it's supposed to be beautiful, and that's not. Like I don't. What are you doing? And yeah, I think I just worry about the company, because I think the nicest thing you can say is that it's a company that got too big for itself. They let the portfolio stagnate. They weren't focused on it. They were building their new campus. They were, you know, they were focused on the iPhone, and they just sort of let this other thing languish. And I just, you know, the fact that they never update the Mac Minis either, I think is more acceptable, because it's like, that's their super low end device. Like,
you know, it doesn't need to be the tip of the spear for all this stuff, but there's something significant about the fact that the most like advanced technologies right now are being developed on platforms that aren't Apple tech platforms.
Like you said, it just, they kept letting meetings slip and getting pushed back for other quote more important things. And it's just, everything got slipped a week. And when you have as many layers and stuff as they do, that translates into 3 years.
Right.
And super easily.
And it becomes all the more frustrating when, as I've mentioned this before, because I think it's worth mentioning, they have to catch up to HP right now. And they could buy HP with cash and still buy five more equally sized companies. Like the fact that Apple, and it's not to say that they should buy HP, it's just amazing to me that a company with that, it's just amazing to me that a company with those sorts of resources can't put together a team that could figure this out. It's a blind spot that goes beyond, oh, we didn't have the technology. It's just a, man, how hard is it to just say, look, we're going to have the most advanced, we're going to have a computer that has all the most advanced like technology that it can be. We're going to charge whatever price it makes sense to sell that. It's going to make sense. It's going to look better than everybody else's because we're going to use polished aluminum, and that's it. Like it's not like this has to, this isn't like the iPhone where you're trying to figure out how to fit, you know, one more piece of technology into a thing that's 1 millimeter thinner. This is an easy one. Like, you know what professional people want. Especially because they saw the Mac Pro stumble so hard. The only explanation that maybe you could come up with that would give you, that I think could give them any coverage, is if they were to say, if they had come out and said, look, that first year of sales on the Mac Pro were phenomenal. It was the best. We were growing the audience for the first time in a decade and for the Mac Pro. So clearly we were on to something, and we just couldn't figure out how to keep that going from a design perspective. And that's what we struggled with, is we knew that that was the general form factor we wanted. We just didn't know how to like carry it forward, which again doesn't make any sense. Like, it's just a crazy idea that you can't make it a little bit bigger, make it a square so that all the fins point together. Like, people have figured this out. This isn't a hard thing to do, Apple. Like, you can buy.
How much do you think their automated manufacturing factory played a role in that decision? Because that was also a huge investment for them. And I don't know. I'm semi get that sense that it was so automated that it actually made it hard to be flexible and dynamic.
No, I totally, that is another excuse that they could use that would be valid. It'd be frustrating coming from Apple, but it would be at least a valid excuse, which is to say what Steve Jobs was saying, manufacturing's never coming back to America. Why? Because we don't have the engineers to handle that sort of production in America. That's not an invalid argument to say that we needed to fundamentally change the design, and that required completely redesigning the factory, which was impossible. So we either needed to scrap the factory, rebuild it, move it to China, where we could do it in China, or fit into the constraints of what the factory was able to produce. And we just couldn't do those. Like, we couldn't figure out how to line any of those three things up. I don't understand how with $150 billion in 3.5 years, you couldn't have figured that out earlier. But
they're busy building the campus. I know. Yeah. No, it's one of those, it's a Titanic moment.
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, I love that scene where it was like, you know, there was like one of 12 things that could go wrong, and it could handle up to three of them going wrong at once, and four things went wrong.
Yeah. You know?
And they were like, and there's like, sorry, it's one too many things. This ship will sink now.
Yeah.
And it was just like, what were the chances that all of those things would happen at once? And you get the sense that it's like, they happen to be building a new campus. Their founder, visionary guy, happened to die. They happened to bet on the wrong technology, and they happen to have some other huge hit products that took a lot of their focus. Yeah, it's just like there's some things here that are playing a role. Whereas like, how do you deal with the fact that like the iPad shot off like a rocket?
I was going to say
shot off like a rocket, and then it flattened out. Which, by the way, if the iPad was its own individual business, like companies would kill for that.
Oh yeah,
but
it'd be one of the most successful.
It's not growing anymore. Yeah. It's just flat and sustaining. And by the way, I think they, what was the math they did? Like if you took away the mini, I forget which one it was. If you looked at just like, I can't remember which one it was. If you get rid of one of the iPads, it's like, oh no, it's growing again. You're just comparing it to this one that's not growing anymore.
Interesting.
But anyways, yeah, it was like the mini's not growing and it was so big that it was it's overshadowing all the other ones. But anyways, the point being, like, that's a distraction as a company who's been used to mobile devices growing. And it's clearly that's an important part of the strategy as well.
Yeah.
And like, that's what all their meetings are about. They're all about iPads. You know, this year they're all about iPhones. But last year they were all about iPads.
Yeah. I wonder about... Yeah. It's interesting reading Mac Daily News. Because they've been a bit on the bandwagon for a while of they've been slowly growing on Apple's case, and you can tell this week was a bit of a breaking point for them emotionally. they were not thrilled. They haven't been saying what I've been saying, which is calling Tim Cook Steve Ballmer for a while, but it's got a bit of that feeling, man. It's just like, yeah, I get that you're piloting the Titanic, but know what you're piloting, man. Look out for icebergs. Understand what your company does. It just seems so foolish to ignore, you know, if you don't have the resources, yeah, you got to make hard choices. But, you know, I get the idea that...
This could sound so dumb, but... I wonder what he does all day sometimes, because they talk about how he's not in the engineering place. He's not hanging out with the designers. What are you spending your time making decisions on?
Yeah.
Like, I don't, it's such a stark contrast, which I know what it is. He's in financial strategic meetings all day long. And, cause that's what HP managers are doing. And I'm always like, that's the dumbest waste of time ever, but whatever. It's important, I guess.
Hey man,
we just fool ourselves.
If you're the CEO, you're hired by the stock, the shareholders, man.
Yeah. To do what? Create products that wow and create value.
To make the stock price go up.
Yeah. And how do you do that?
By playing,
creating products that wow and customers like and love.
If you're Steve Jobs, you understand that, but it's amazing how many CEOs.
Bill Gates got it too.
Yeah, well,
I think Jeff Bezos gets it.
And you want to know what those three
Larry Page and Sergey Brin.
Yeah, you want to know what those guys have in common? They're worth incredible amounts of money and built in enormous companies. But you want to know what happens to the guy after them? They become Steve Ballmer or evidently Tim Cook. I don't know, man. I don't know. It just drives me nuts because Tim Cook seems like a real nice guy. He's not weird like Steve Ballmer with his weird ways, but he's. I just have a feeling that
he's a number two. That's the problem. He's a number two.
I was going to say I have a feeling in a couple of years, Steve or Tim Cook is going to step down after much frustration. And, you know, he'll have guided the ship pretty well with quite a few different things. And then, and probably at the same time, Johnny Ives is going to step down. And then somebody else is going to come along, a Satya Nadella type, and just be like, okay, time to unleash the engines of Apple again. Like, let's get back on the ship. The only difference being...
Let's get back on the pirate ship.
There we go.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I could see it go either way. Cook would have to be super honest with himself for him to recommend, because that's what's going to happen. He's not going to get fired. He's going to retire, and it's going to be based on his recommendation and who he's grooming. I'm looking at the current suite, and clearly Johnny Ive doesn't want
that.
Craig Federighi.
See,
that's my number one hope. But
Federighi's got his own weaknesses that I've read about. But I think what's interesting about Cook
Like you said, I think one of the interesting differences that you're saying here is that Ballmer had the problem that Bill Gates still existed, still was involved in the company, still cared very much, and still had a very large voice. And so he could sit there and say, look, you're not doing the job you should be. We need somebody else. Let's start looking. And whereas there's no equivalent of it at Apple. Like, the most senior dude with the most weight is Tim Cook right now, because Steve Jobs isn't there anymore. There's nobody with the gravitas to tell Tim Cook, you're fired. whereas Gates obviously didn't tell Ballmer, you're fired, but he was able to voice his displeasure, which sent everything in a particular direction.
Yeah.
And there's nobody with that kind of gravitas at Apple to unseat Cook. So like you said, it'd have to be his own honesty or just an unbelievable cacophony from the shareholders.
Or he's got a great board. I don't know who's on his board, but someone who he likes and trusts, who just comes beside him and says, look, man, you're number two. We tried the number one thing. It's not working.
Yeah.
And it's weird for you to go back to being chief operations officer, but like, that's your job. That's where you shine. And he'll admit it and go, yeah, that's what he's great at. And that's what he's done great at for Apple.
Yeah. Well, and it adds to the frustration that it's a company that never missed a deadline, always had enough. Like, the worst things that Apple ever did was that they'd have constrained supply after giant launches of the iPhone. And you're like, that was almost intentional to a degree, because it was like,
felt that way. And yeah.
Whereas it wasn't like they ever just let products slip for months. Whereas that's happened now that Tim Cook, the operations genius, is CEO. And is it because he's distracted, or is it because...
That was because Jobs was able to say no, right? Yeah. To say, no, we're not going to focus on this anymore. Cut.
Yeah.
Done. You know, and he... It would be interesting to look at how many products have been discontinued under his watch. I feel like it's less than five.
Hmm. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know, man. It feels like the whole thing is listing and still, and the fact that they're going to take their time to try to correct this ship, and because the worst part about them telling when they were going to launch the next, you know, Mac Pro was that it was like, it's not going to be this year, which implies that it's next year, but it doesn't tell you it's next year. It could be 2019. That's not off the table. It could be late 2018 very easily, which would mean you'd be pushing. They'd be still selling a pro computer that they launched 5 years ago.
Well, they gave them all spec boosts. So
no. Okay. That's unfair. They didn't do spec boosts. They did a price cut. So all they did was they took the same old architectures, the same old tech, and they moved it, the price. They got rid of the lowest echelon and made the next echelon that price, which.
Yeah, but yes. They added a new high level, didn't they?
I don't think so. I don't believe so.
I thought they did.
And the problem is that it's like, okay, that's fine, but you're still struggling to keep up with much cheaper NVIDIA equivalent stuff, and even AMD's more modern stuff. Like the idea of the dual GPU was a dead end 3 years ago, and that will have been going on 4 years of dead end, like stuff that hasn't been developed. Just the performance isn't there, and you're trying to sell this to professionals. Just drives me crazy.
I would not also be surprised to hear behind the scenes they were trying to get it developed and try to be that market leader.
Yeah.
You know, you try that for a couple of years until you find like, ah, dang it, this isn't going to work.
Yeah.
I could see that too.
Yeah. And I, you know, it just seems, things seem off the rails, man. And it's frustrating to me because I'm like, you know, my eyes are wandering, man. I'm looking over the wall, seeing what's available. And
this is a foreshadow of what's to come. I think about like the car industry And there was a time when those were all the same. Those were all the founders running those things, and they were pushing the bounds of what cars could do and really doing some really cool things. And then eventually all those founders left the companies for various reasons. And now they're led by just, I'm going to call them regular CEOs, and they're just doing regular things. And it's not fun to look at them anymore. And you get that same sense of like, man, in 20, 30 years, that's what the tech industry is going to be like. Because all of these companies who we love, like, they're not going to have the original founders anymore. And I'm willing to bet more of them are going to be like Cook than will be like Satya. That's what happened in the car industry.
Well, I would guarantee.
Then the technology matures and you move into a new industry.
But I'd almost guarantee that that's what's going to happen with the consumer electronic computers.
We're just getting a taste of it super early because of an early death. And, yeah. And which is kind of sad. We'll have to pivot our podcast. Space podcast.
When I talk about looking over the wall, man, I'm going to be totally honest. I'm not just talking about looking over the wall at PCs. I'm thinking, you know, there's some pretty cool Android phones coming out, man, with some features that Apple's not doing anything to convince me they're keeping up with. You know, we'll see what they come out this year, but if they don't come out with a pretty impressive AR platform, I am not going to get the next iPhone. I'm going to get an Android phone that's got Tango, like, built in. And if I've got enough money, I might just get both. Like, I'm ready to get onto that bandwagon with your VR AR stuff. And yeah, if Apple doesn't come in like Apple should come into this, I don't really see a reason to stick with it. And I, with the exception of Apple Watch, that's the one thing I come back to, is like, just, it's just the best. It is. It's better than anything that the Android Wear stuff. It just better performance, better overall. You can get something that has equivalent performance, but it's ugly as sin. Or you can get something that looks as good as an Apple Watch, but its battery doesn't last the whole day. What? Or it doesn't have a health tracker. Like, what am I? What? I don't know. I don't want to downgrade the Apple Watch, but that's the last thing in the ecosystem that I'm really convinced is the undisputed champion that Apple offers. And, you know, it might take a couple of years for Android to figure out how to keep up with that. You know, which would be frustrating to me. I'd hate to downgrade my wrist again. But, you know, I don't know, man. I'm frustrated.
Well, the best way to vent your frustration is through video. And Apple's got you covered for
that, too. This is a weird pivot.
They came out with a new app this week.
Okay.
And I was actually shocked that Lifehacker totally missed it in their analysis. It's not very often a Lifehacker doesn't get it, but they didn't. Anyways, it's called Clips.
Okay.
I'm going to link to the Verge article because I thought their analysis was right on. And essentially, it's, think of it this way. It's iMovie Lite.
Okay.
It's not Snapchat or Instagram. It's iMovie Lite. So the idea is you download and turn on the app and you get yourself a square video and you can either add a video. It's, you're making video, okay? Let's be very clear. This is not a picture. This is video. You have an option to add a photo, but it's really, you take a photo, and then you get to select how long the video shows the photo. You can record a video, or you can even go to your library and add a video or still photo, again, into a video. Once you have selected your video, so, hey, this is James with the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast making an awesome video. Okay, I just recorded a video, just like that. You can then select the video. You can trim it. You can add the audio. Let's see. What did I do here?
It's James with the Frillo Bros Tech Podcast making an awesome video.
See, done that. Then what you could do is you can add like text over it while you're talking.
Yeah.
You okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're making something. So
they have the ink overlay, and I smiled, and it looks like I got junk on my teeth, which I'm not really happy about.
Yeah, so that's the thing. So I can, this is a recording, and somehow it will pop up on the screen. Okay, I did it, but it's not showing it to me. How come I didn't do it? This is a recording, and somehow it will pop up onto the screen. Huh. I hear that's the weirdest part of this thing, but the idea is you don't have to type in your text, you just say it.
Yeah.
Anyways, the other thing that it has filters, like a comic book, a faded, which is probably one of my favorite, ink. Oh, my teeth look pretty good. The ink's actually really cool. It's just like black and white.
Yeah, it is very cool.
I guess. You can add stickers on top. Like I'm going to add the time. That is 9:45 p.m. And then I could add a transition, but I'm not going to because that's dumb. And then you hit done. Oh, mine is actually... Oh, that's interesting. So you can record... I did not know that. So you could record multiple clips and then you can put them together and then you can even add transition slides like this, then that, like the overlay, like we just talked about. And then you have to share it. You can either share it over iMessage or, what are the other options? You have, well, whatever your normal share sheet would show, right? So messages, mail, Facebook, Messenger, Vimeo, Instagram, YouTube, whatever. And you share it.
Nice.
It's iMovie Lite.
I like it.
So the way I heard it described was like it's not like let me take a quick video and then share it. Like no, you take some video, sit down in a quiet place for 5 minutes. Do some super light editing, and then
I will say this: as I weave wildly back and forth between loving and hating Apple, I think this is a really promising sign of a change. Apple is notorious for waiting to like launch these sorts of applications with the operating system. Like, oh, we've got new stuff, and they leave. Like, this is the sort of thing that in years past, they would wait till WWDC to announce that they're going to do this and then actually not launch the app until they launch the operating system. The fact that they just launched a new app that's just kind of a dumb or a utility more or less sort of mid-cycle is much more like a normal tech company. Seems kind of healthy to be like, oh, new features are available for just because we're done developing it. Like that to me, I think is a really good sign. Like this particular utility, you know, we'll see how it performs. It seems to function well. You know, it fills a niche in Apple's larger communications platform that everybody else has a similar feature for, whether it's like, you know, Instagram has their editing software and or / Facebook and, you know, all these different tools. So Apple basically has launched their own editing software. Like you said, it's iMovie's Lite, and it's meant specifically for the messaging sharing ecosystem. And it's just interesting, you know, to me, the biggest thing to comment on it about, like I said, is just the timing of it. The fact that they launched it mid-cycle, they announced it a couple of weeks ago, they launched it a few weeks later. It doesn't coincide with any other big launch. And I'm hoping that that means that this is not Apple trying to say, look, we launched something in the fall. This doesn't occur the spring or whatever we're in. Like, this doesn't count, Apple. Well, I'm still upset with you about nothing, not launching anything. But they, you know, the fact that they are launching software updates, though, like I said, I think that's good. Because it's not good enough to do giant software updates. You know, it's not good enough to do iterative improvements on your platform once a year. It really isn't. Like, iTunes should have iterative improvements every couple of months.
Yeah.
And then you can do giant overhauls of the style and everything once a year when you really get everybody's attention, and you can and you can explain it and get all the media's attention involved. But you should be doing more than bug fixes in the interim. Especially with something like iMessages, which is a very successful platform right now. It's huge, and you should keep it that way. And this is the way that you keep it that way, which is add more features, add more supporting applications mid-cycle. Keep people excited about it, and keep it growing. So, I don't know. I like it. Glad to see it, man.
Yeah. Pretty fun.
Apple is a completely healthy company. They're doing great. Good job, Tim Cook. Jeez.
Oh, man.
So you brought up something earlier, and I want to bring it up again. The fact that...
Rockets?
Not quite yet. That one's next.
Oh, okay.
This time, we're going to talk about self-driving cars and how, evidently, the big motor companies in in Detroit, they are leading the charge.
That is the dumbest thing I've heard. Tell more about this. I saw that and couldn't believe it.
So this article that I read, basically, it was a report that Tesla is now. Let me jump to where it actually what I want to read. That's the assessment of Navigant Research, which scored 18 companies working on self-driving technology on 10 different criteria related to strategy, manufacturing, and execution. The report then combined all that into an overall score to get a sense of who's ahead and who's not. General Motors and Ford are currently leading the pack, while Daimler and Renault Nissan are close behind. Those four companies make up Navigant's leader category. In other words, when you climb into your first self-driving car in 2021, it will almost certainly be built by one of those four companies. This is the dumbest, like, so they have this, like, if you go to the Verge article that actually had this, they have a picture of the chart with all the different companies in their different, like, categories and stuff. They have four different categories: followers, challengers, contenders, and leaders. There's nobody in the followers category. Why would you have a category that nobody's in? Like, why not just not have the category?
Because it's absolute. Okay?
I know. Like, well, it reminds me of the we'll turn it up to 11. Like, you can adjust the scale. But so
no one knew until you published.
So they're saying the challengers, which is like way down in the background, are Uber and Honda. They're saying the contenders are Tesla's towards the bottom of the contenders, Waymo, which is Google's self-driving or Alphabet self-driving company, formerly Google Cars. They're in the mid range. And then obviously, like I said, Ford and GM are your market leaders, according to this research group. And one of the things that I think is so dumb about this article is that, yeah, it seems kind of like obviously right, because even Google is saying, we don't want to build cars. We want to build operating systems. Like in Uber, they're like, we don't want to build cars. We want to own every car. We want to own the infrastructure. Like, it just seems like a really weird way to like judge these companies and be like, oh yeah, no, Tesla's like the one that is, I think, most upsetting is Tesla's way in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're basically saying like,
well, I saw that and then went, oh, that's why this is a joke. Okay.
Yeah. Because it's like, realistically, if you want to buy a self-driving car in the next three years, there's only going to be one car that you can buy that has those features. And it's going to be Tesla. So realistically, if in the next couple of years, you know, if 2021, you want to be in a self-driving car, you're probably going to be saving up for a Tesla.
Well, that was the other thing that I didn't like about this. I'm like, so this is clearly not a snapshot of today. It's a snapshot of what they think it will be in 20 years.
3 years?
What? Well, it could be three. Well,
I know. This is just,
it's just not where it's at today. Because well, today, Tesla is the clear leader.
I think what's so interesting about this to me is, that's a good point. Tesla is the clear leader today. And because they're successfully pushing out these features, like, which is crazy that they wouldn't be towards the top. They're building cars and pushing out the features. And yes, GM, Ford, and Chrysler are going to be top companies when it comes to actually manufacturing these things. And in the world as it stands right now, but that's because they're going to partner with Uber and Lyft and
Waymo,
like, and those guys will build the operating systems. And I don't know if you've noticed, but being the hardware partner for the software guys usually works out best for the software guys. It's crazy to me that this is like praising GM and Ford. This should be the heaviest criticism of GM and Ford. Like, your best case scenario right now is that you're going to be the guys building them. You're not going to be the ones profiting from them. So how do you want to deal with that? Like, how do you want to change up what you're doing so you don't get left behind?
Yeah, what they don't understand is a company like Waymo, because Google has done this, is they're going to say, hey, this technology is available to GM, Ford, Daimler, BMW, Hyundai, VW, Volvo, Tesla. They're just going to make it available to all of them.
Right.
And if they're the best, which I have a hunch they will be, like, they're all eventually going to switch over to
it. That's really funny. Speaking of Waymo being the best. So right now, Waymo is suing Uber for stealing suing all of their trade secrets. Uber's defense is legitimately, no, we can prove we didn't steal it because of how much worse our cars are than Google's.
I did notice that.
That is their defense. Look, if we stole from them, you'd think we'd be doing better than we are, but we're not. So clearly, we're not using their tech, which is a pretty...
What was it? It was Justice Allslop? Is that how you say his name? Where he was like, in the 42 years that I've been a judge, I have never seen such a comprehensive preponderance of evidence. She's like, oh man, not good.
Yeah.
And poor Uber, where like the main guy in the case gets his own lawyer and pleads the fifth and won't show his own personal PC, because Uber can prove that none of the files are on their PCs.
Yeah.
But he refuses to show his personal one, which they're just like, shoot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I guess that's the funniest part about this is that, like, the funniest worst part is that Uber is going to lose this lawsuit. They're going to lose bad, because at this point, at least circumstantially, it seems entirely clear what happened, which is exactly what you're like, the dude took all this stuff, brought it over to Uber, is probably like their patent infringement stuff, even though it's not using Google specific stuff, it's using stuff that he shouldn't have had during his time at Google. And on top of that, their performance is terrible. They're like, they're going to get it from both ends here. We stole from Google and we stole poorly.
And we're just going to get pounded
for it. Oh man. That is a rough place to be. Whew. But yeah,
they're going to have the best. I mean, you could already see that going, and I get where other companies, like, their strategy is to try to hire Waymo employees away to try to catch up. I get it. That was Uber's strategy. They teamed up with a guy who's not so altruistic, you know, surprise, surprise.
I know.
And you know that Tesla's trying to hire Waymo folks, and at one point in time, Apple was. And so you know they're all doing it, but I don't know, man. The way that Google works,
I know. I just, I completely agree. I'm entirely on the same page. I look at this chart. I'm just staring at this chart and thinking, like, it just feels like it's built backwards. Like, and I actually think I have a theory for why. I'm pretty sure that Navigant Research is an industry researcher. And they're trying to convince
that
they're trying to convince investors. No, trust Detroit. Detroit's going to be the one.
Navigant, it's navigation.
Yeah,
they've got to be an industry researcher.
And yeah, I think that they're basically trying to prove is that Silicon Valley is not going to beat Detroit in this game. And in their attempt,
classic. These computer guys aren't just going to come in and teach us how to drive.
Exactly. Uh-huh. It's exactly. And it just feels like one of those situations where Google will happily never build a car in their entire existence. And you'll just, because, and this is the thing, if it's a $30,000 car and you have to, like, even though your company will have gross margins way beyond, you sell a $30,000 car, you have to manufacture a $30,000 car. There is a fixed minimum, like, cost that will come out of you in just raw materials, the resources, the physical resources to build a car, not to mention the infrastructure of building
Tesla.
Updating those people, all that that's involved. Google has the distinct advantage. If they're selling the software, it is built out of an infinitely replicatable medium. There is literally no limits to how many times they can replicate this software at no cost to them. They just give you the software in a download. They give you the software, and then you replicate it into the hardware that you're selling to the end customer. And if Uber has their way, they'll buy all the cars. And so all of a sudden, instead of negotiating with individual customers and having your entire network of dealerships, you're going to start dealing with fewer and bigger car companies, like car companies that just own fleets of cars. Instead of negotiating with one-on-one customers, you're now negotiating with somebody who has some leverage, who can say, oh, you don't want to give me, you know, that $1,000 off per car? Ford? Fine. I'll just go and buy them from GM. I don't care. They use the same software. Like, I feel like whether it's Uber's strategy or Waymo's strategy, both of those strategies put GM and Ford and Daimler into a really rough position. And, you know, I just...
Well, it's like you said, I think it's most apt is they're at huge risk of just turning into OEMs.
Yeah.
That no one cares about.
Yeah.
Because it's all about what's inside. And we're all listening to our CarPlay or Android Play while in the vehicle. And yeah, no, it was an interesting report where I was like, just stunk. But I read a better article about it that it's by Benedict Evans. And it talked about cars and second order consequences. Okay. So I thought that was really interesting where he was like, there are two main trends right now, electric cars and autonomous cars. And he goes, there's some obvious ones, you know, as a result of them. But so he starts out with electric and he's like, one of them, where he's, again, it's like, less noise, right, is one of them. And in theory, less pollution as well. And it's like, those are cool types of consequences of it. But there's other things. Like, he talks about the fact that you get rid of the fuel tank and you replace it with a battery. He's like, that totally changes things. For example, roughly half of U.S. spending on car maintenance goes on things that are directly attributable to the internal combustion engine. He goes, and a lot of it will just go away. and he goes, and it might also affect the lifespan of a vehicle. He goes, in an on-demand world, vehicles will have a higher loading, but absent of that, fewer mechanical breakages. Which, so it might mean that there's actually a longer replacement cycle once the rate of technology implementation settles down. The next thing he talks about is that there are 150,000 gas stations in the USA. And he goes, those will probably go away. And he goes, and they actually sell their gas at a relatively low margin. He goes, and where they actually make their money is as convenience stores. Right. He goes, so what happens to those? And what happens when the demand for those products goes down? For example, tobacco sells a meaningful portion of their total volume as an impulse purchase attached to gasoline.
Wow. That's really interesting to me because, like, I was going to say, like, I'm...
It's well over half their sales happen in gas stations.
I'm a fat kid. So my thought immediately was, well, I'm not going to stop going. I'm, like, if I want a snack, like, I like going to the 7-Eleven, right? And I'm going to do... I'll keep going to, like, these stores. But it's that impulse buy. It's the... Not everybody's a fat kid. People come out of their way to go to Kmart. They go to them because they're at the gas station. Like, they got to stop for 5 minutes, and they're kind of thirsty, so they might as well get something to drink while they're at it. And, yeah, that does make a difference.
Another one, gasoline is taxed. Some places, like the UK, it's 4% of the revenue. But he's like, it's going to have to be replaced. And so there will. He goes, we're going to tax other things that may be more elastic. That's an economic term. Things that are elastic means they are more price sensitive. So gas is typically considered inelastic. No matter what the price is, you're probably going to buy it.
Right.
It's a general rule. Things that are more elastic, if the price gets a little higher, you may think twice about it.
Movie tickets. You're like, if yeah. movie tickets go up 10%, you might go to the movie because you've been... You know, you're already at the theater and you'll get the tickets and you'll be frustrated, but you'll think hard about it next Friday. Like, that's very common for people.
Yeah. The other one that I've seen are nutrition bars. When they're on sale, people will buy them by the bucket loads, literally loads by boxes of them. But, like, I know a guy, he likes Clif bars. And he's like, yeah, they go on sale like twice a year. And when they do, I buy as many as I can.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I don't. It's just not worth
I've looked into... Yeah, I'm actually the exact same with I'm a Clif Bar guy, and there are places where it's like I will never pay more than a dollar per bar for them because I know that, like, as long as you buy them in a box, you can get them for a dollar per bar, and if you get a little bit creative, you can go and so I'm always buying them dozens at a time. But if it's $1.25, I won't buy it. I'll starve instead. Jeez, I won't. I'm a.
Meanwhile, you still will actually need to charge your EVs. Most estimates suggest that charging a fully electronic fleet would lead to 10 to 20% more electricity demand, which I was like, wow, that seems really low. But maybe that's right. But he goes, but a big part of it is when. If they're charged during off-peak, goes, may not be a big deal. But if you need to charge them during on-peak, he goes, that could cause some real interesting problems for the power grid. And he goes, and that's obviously why Elon Musk is headed down the track of large batteries in your home.
Yeah.
Right? And so part of that is to push the battery volume up so that you don't have to worry about the peak hours nearly as much. But I thought the biggest one, the interesting thing was, again, it's getting rid of those gas stations is going to have an impact on other industries around it, tobacco being one of them, which he was quick to point out, like, car accidents cause about 35,000 deaths a year, whereas tobacco causes about 500,000 deaths a year.
Woo.
And so if you can get rid of half the sales, yeah, it may be okay. Speaking of reducing deaths, the next thing he talks about is the autonomy of cars. And he says, oh, no, this doesn't make any sense anymore. He says, I guess, oh, this must be, okay, so there are about a million people globally die every year from a car accident, which again, what was the 35K estimate later? Anyways, Let's see, in the U.S., okay, there were 13 million collisions, 1.7 caused injuries, 2.4 million were injured, and 35,000 people were killed. Okay, so that was a U.S. stat. Anyways, 90% are mostly caused by driver error, and a third of all of them involved alcohol. So he was saying, just looking beyond the fact that those will be reduced, he estimates, the government estimates that a cost of $240 billion a year is spent on property damage, medical and emergency services, legal work, lost work, congestion, which is pretty crazy. And so what they'll find is those costs will be saved.
Right.
Which is nice. And he was even saying a simple level 3 system may cut many kinds of accidents, which would be very cool. What was the other one? He was talking about how, you know, eventually if you get rid of essentially all accidents, which if all cars on the road are level 5, in theory, you should be fine. It's like, you're going to have situations where cars can drive safely 2 feet apart at 80 miles an hour.
Right.
He just talks about how, like, just roads will start to look different because you won't need stoplights or stop signs because cars will be able to just navigate it on their own. He talks about how, parking lots will become a thing that's just not needed anymore because cars, well, or it won't have to be right next to the store. It could be somewhere else because it could go drive. And he actually talks about how this is weird, like, in theory, you can reduce congestion, but because of things like that, where like you maybe don't have a parking lot right next to you, he goes, that increases congestion.
Yeah.
And so he's like, so maybe, you know, who knows? We'll see.
Yeah. You're only going to be, yeah. I mean, the classic example would be you're in San Francisco and they get rid of all parking structures and stuff. So your car just drops you off to the shopping center. You know, you're only going to be there for half an hour. And so in sending it outskirts of the city to park, you just tell it to drive around for a bit. Come pick me up later, which increases congestion because it's on the road more, obviously.
Right, because another thing that could increase it would be it should displace the demand for public transportation if it truly is that on-demand type of driving. He's like, so, you know, who knows? What was the other one? Oh, yeah, and then he just talks about how there'll be a ton of jobs that kind of disappear. You know, taxi drivers, private car drivers, long-haul truck drivers. Add it all up, it's almost about 2 million people in the U.S. That probably have to go find something else to do.
But that probably... They'll go and figure it out. There's no way there will be another level of automation to wipe out whatever next job they find.
Oh, then he also talked about how big box retail is obviously based on an arbitrage of land costs and transportation costs and people's willingness to drive and park. It's like autonomy will probably change the way that looks.
Right.
And it will make a lot more sense to have a lot denser cities and kind of go that route and have stores slim down and be simpler.
One of the tweets that he sent out was, I still think autonomous cars will create more billionaires in real estate and retail than in tech or manufacturing, just as cars did. Getting to that point of cars changed, not just, you know, cars changed how we spent money, and actually, so the people who we were driving to made more money than the people who were allowing us to drive. And the same will happen with autonomous vehicles. It changes how you drive. So the people who are selling the cars aren't going to be making a ton of money off all this. And actually the people who will be making the most money are the people who are doing the value added proposition. The people who have actually added the value, which will be the software guys, which will be Google, which brings me back to the question of what the heck was that other article talking about?
Yeah. And then his final one was, he goes, remember the cameras. And he goes, there's going to be a camera watching everything now, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be on the road. It's going to be recording everything to some degree. And he goes, it may not be uploading every part of it, but they could. He goes, so if you think to like 2030, if it's police investigating a crime, they won't just get copies of the CCTV from surrounding properties, but they'll get copies of the sensor data from every car that happened to be passing around in that area from the company, not from the individual.
Right.
It's like, and so surveillance is going to be very different, potentially, probably, as a result.
But, and by potentially, probably, he means certainly, definitely, absolutely, without question.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I promised I would talk about rockets, so let's talk about it real quick. Like, did you know that Jeff Bezos is the second richest man on Earth?
Oh, man. Is Carlos Slim still beating him, or is he a thing of the past?
He's a thing of the past, man. Carlos Slim is down to, like, the sixth spot. He's down low.
That's what he gets for being in real estate.
Yeah, actually, it depends on the hour that you're checking on their particular stock value. Jeff Bezos jumps between second and third with Warren Buffett. Billy Gates is still the top dog, despite him.
Thanks to Satya.
No, man. It's really helping out. And then
that's crazy, man. You think about how much money Gates is spending on his foundation, and he's still number one.
He keeps selling giant chunks of his company, and he's still number one. What was I going to say? Yes, but Jeff is worth like $70 billion currently, and so he announced this week that he is going to start selling $1 billion worth of his stock every year for as long as it takes to beat Elon Musk in space. basically, he's going to be liquidating his Amazon stock and investing it in Blue Origin so that they have the capital to not just build landing reusable rockets like SpaceX, but to do bigger ones faster. They're working on the John Glenn rock right now. We're going to be trying to do the New Glenns shortly, which will be significantly bigger than the ones they're working on, all with the goal of doing geosync launches with the biggest payloads possible, landing the rockets and reusing them a couple hours later, which is what Tesla's trying to do too. Pretty crazy. It's exciting, man. Yeah. Space race is heating up again. It is a completely different type of space race. And I have a feeling that Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk are going to absolutely hate each other at the end of this. Like, which is going to be weird because I feel like they're both kind of doing it for semi-altruistic like purposes, but it almost is going to make them hate each other like more because they shouldn't be mad at each other, but they will be. Yeah, pretty aggressive though, man. Getting into it. SpaceX proved that it was possible to do on a regular. You know, obviously they're proving this technology. Technically, Blue Origin's landed a rocket first. If you remember, we talked about it. It was a much smaller rocket that did a straight up and straight down, as opposed to delivering something into orbit, which is much harder to do. Bezos's team is getting into the game and they're going to be launching rockets, man. It's exciting. Also, Jeff Bezos is the third richest person on Earth. That actually doesn't include the richest people on Earth, but that's because they're all dictators and they like to hide their wealth. They don't want anybody to know how rich they are because it would be bad for their dictating. Putin is clearly worth more than Bill Gates. Some estimates would ballpark it around five times Bill Gates' current wealth, which is enough to blow your mind. And he's not the only one. There's a reason why Assad wants to keep his gig. It's because it's worth a whole lot of money. Dictating is
It's interesting, though, right now he's second, third, whatever. But back in early 2000, they had just hired a new chief financial officer from Delta. His name was Warren Jensen. And he decided that the company needed a stronger cash position. as a hedge against the possibility that nervous suppliers might ask to be paid more quickly for the products that Amazon sold. And so they actually tapped into the European market. So in February of 2000, Amazon sold, or no, 2001, Amazon sold almost $7 million in convertible bonds to overseas investors. When they did it, the stock market was starting to fluctuate and the global economy was tipping into a recession. And so they ended up giving a lot better interest rates, 6.9%. And the deal was completed just a month before the crash of the stock market.
Really? And
after which it was like almost impossible for any company to raise any money. And had they not had that $700 million cushion, they almost certainly would have gone bankrupt.
Wow.
So one of those, like, a little bit of luck,
yeah,
a little bit of smartness on, you know, getting the smart CFO in there. But they did it for the wrong reason, but, you know, hey, that's whatever.
That's
right?
Amazing.
Yeah. And one of the other things that I thought was really interesting is that, what was it? A lot of what ultimately made Amazon what we think and know of it today, it all happened super late. So like his whole two pizza teams, that idea of like, we're going to move fast and break things fast.
Yeah.
That wasn't until 2002 that they started that. Their marketplace where third party people could start selling stuff on their site.
Yeah.
Not just books. That was launched in November of 2000. They debuted Prime in 2005, and in 2005 it did its 2-day shipping thing to some third party sellers.
Okay.
Amazon Web Services didn't come along until 2006.
I knew that was super late in the game, which was kind of amazing.
Yeah, and so it's one of those where it was like, man, back in 2000 they sold books.
Yeah,
that's what they did. That was their thing.
Yeah,
and. And it's like, you know, which is crazy to think, you know, 17 years later, holy cow.
Yeah.
but his whole point, she goes, sounds a whole lot like Uber, doesn't it? I'm like, maybe. Maybe if you just squint your eyes a little bit and go, okay, a company that seems to be doing one thing and could potentially be in trouble. I think what he's trying to say is that if Uber can somehow come out of this trap that they've got themselves in, though I would argue they did not set themselves up smart for their current situation, they could come out very strong and in a good
position.
I would
say this. My argument for why I was... Because I was pretty positive on Uber up until very recently. And the reason for that is because of this sense of like, they've got something going on. They've got a culture that is, because that's the thing that Bezos built up, right? He built a culture. He got the right people in place to be able to capitalize on these sorts of ideas and really grow the company at amazing paces, take on new projects and succeed and stabilize them very quickly. And Uber seemed to be doing the same thing. Yeah, they had one product they were working on, but it just had that feeling of like, okay, they're going to pivot here at some point. They're going to get into some new market, and all of a sudden things are going to get crazy and explosive. The only thing that it's become exceedingly clear is there is a different side to their culture that doesn't seem to be present at a lot of these other companies that have followed a similar path. And that's the whole, like, not just move fast and break things, but steal things and get in legal trouble. Like they get really, you know, I think the whole thing going on with auto right now and being sued by Google, that's a systemic issue. You're seeing that same story replayed multiple different ways in the company. And it doesn't seem to be sort of a pile on thing right now. It seems to be, no, they've got some real issues with disregard for the law and that's a difference that might be super important. And, you know, and it's like Google had a lot of disrespect for
patent law. But they've paid a steep price for that in many ways. And for that rapid progress, and they had to weather that storm, but it's possible to get yourself in so much trouble that you just can't get out of it and capitalize in the ways that you otherwise would be able to. You know, I still think Uber's got enough potential that they're going to keep growing and being aggressive, but it might cost them these Amazon-like opportunities. You know, you're bringing up the example of the little known cash deal. You know, is Uber in the middle of their personal version of this story, except they don't have the cash pile to make it through? I don't know, man. Okay, I got one last story I want to talk about. Have you been following the story of Cater Wilkerson, a man who just wants to get his nugs?
I retweeted it.
I retweeted it too. So for the record, Carter Wilkerson is at, let's see here, 2.2 million tweets. He is well over two-thirds of the way to getting to the most retweeted tweet of all time. He is only one-ninth of the way to his goal of 18 million retweets. This morning, Carter Wilkerson just decided, yo, at Wendy's, how many retweets for a year of free chicken nuggets? And Wendy's, just a little bit later in the morning, replied with saying 18 million. That's all they said. And he
I love the people running that account. Yeah, it's so awesome.
And he all responded, right, consider it done. So he took a screenshot and he's tweeted that. And like I said, it's at 2.2 million tweets right now. But one of the greatest things that's ever happened is happening. So he retweeted a screenshot. So obviously there's your normal metadata that comes on your Apple's home screen, like your carrier. So John Ledger, the CEO of T-Mobile, tweeted him, hey, at Cater JWM, sorry you have at AT&T, switch to at T-Mobile, and I'll give you a year free at Wendy's chicken nuggets myself, plus more, seriously. And Carter Wilkinson responded, hey, at Verizon, anything you want to say? At T-Mobile, at AT&T. LinkedIn responded, you got this, hashtag nugs for Carter. Wendy's responded at some point, wow, 1.8, almost didn't see the decimal point, still on a roll. Trolling him. Oh man, nugs for Carter, this is amazing. Governor Sandoval, who's the governor of the state that he's in, Nevada's in, how about you, govs, just hashtagged a bunch of Governor Jerry Brown, Governor New York, Governor Cuomo. It's just, this is great. Google, feeling lucky at Carter JWM, hashtag nugs for Carter. Oh man, everybody's good at getting in on it. Yeah, this is awesome. This is the sort of thing we can all get behind, James.
this is blue dress right here.
Yeah, it totally is. And the best part is, there's no way he's going to get even close to 18 million, but I think everybody's okay with that. At this point, we just want to beat Ellen. Can Carter beat Ellen? That's what we need, man. It definitely, you know what the best part about this too is, this happened Sunday morning, which means that all the national talk shows are going to be wanting to talk about this tomorrow morning on Good Morning America. I guarantee you, A&G, Armstrong and Getty, the guys that I listen to regularly, they're going to be talking about it in their newscasts. So this is not done. This is going to get bigger tomorrow when the national news media finally kicks in and decides they need a fluff piece for Monday morning, because it's like politics has been a little bit too serious and nothing else is going on. Like, there's nothing else that's disrupted the news flow today. So we're going to make it to, we're going to beat Ellen. I'm so excited. And this is good, man. This is going to be awesome.
I'm ready for it. There's nothing out. There's he's got full clearance. Full clearance ahead. The only thing that could happen is if it turns out like he's got a weird Reddit history, you know, that could be disruptive. That sometimes ruins these guys. But yeah, it's going to be great. It's good stuff.
Super funny.
I'm totally.
Got to help Carter get his nugs.
Oh, man. That's. And Wendy's set it up perfectly too by making the goal line impossible. I was just it's like, because you know these accounts, these departments, they have a certain budget for this kind of stuff, and it's like, they'll sat around and wonder, how much would it cost to do this? Well, it costs like half our budget. Okay, let's make it worth it then. 18 million.
Well, that was fun. did you see one of the tweets where someone did the math? They're like, this will cost Wendy $650 at most.
Yeah, that's if you give them four a day, because that's what they said. The small pack is like four, and then you can get that for like $2. So it comes to like your running total of like, yeah, it's times 356. It's a couple hundred dollars.
It's nothing. Yeah. It almost makes the 18 million.
I know. Yeah.
She's like, holy cow.
Oh man, yeah. You get a good team behind you on these like Twitter accounts, and it's worth some serious. Like those guys are earning. They literally with two words, 18 million. That department earned their entire pay this year.
That's what you need to have running Twitter accounts. It's like, call me your writers who are clean.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that's all you need.
Yeah, exactly. Oh man. This is going to be awesome. I love John Ledger. Oh, sorry about AT&T. Okay, I'll give you free chicken McNuggets for a year if you switch to T-Mobile. Oh, it's so good. So good.
I would have switched.
I know. I would have been like, I'm in.
Why would you even ask AT&T and Verizon to counter?
I know.
Just boom, done. That my next tweet would have been a screenshot with T-Mobile.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you would have screenshotted it, been gone in with like MS Paint and like scribbled over it like a close by color, and then just like hand drawn in T-Mobile. Oh man,
that's
for Carter. I love it.
The internet, it's fantastic. Stuff, it is good stuff. All right. Well, that's all we got. So thanks for joining us and listening to episode 289. We appreciate it. Super fun. Don't forget, you can check out all the show notes and all the links at furloughbros.com. Again, episode 289. And if you'd like the show notes sent directly to you, we got an email address. You just put in your information there. It'll work. And finally, this podcast is supported by listeners just like you. And so you can check out furloughbros.com for how you too can become a patron. All right, with that, I am James Furlough, and my opening day pitch brother is Matthew Furlough, and so we will talk next time. Thank you.